Heart of the Matter, where we slice up today's divisive political issues into bite-sized portions.
In other words, we discuss the issues in such a way that even your husband can understand.
The thing that separates us from the animals is our ability to accessorize.
Heart of the Matter is hosted by the Americhicks.
The men will be so excited.
The Americhicks are Kim Monson and Molly Vogt.
Molly is a former mutual fund consultant and retirement plan specialist who is currently the director and founder of My Purse Politics. Kim served as a city councilwoman, is a former investment broker, and is now enjoying a successful career as an entrepreneur.
There isn't any room at the top for local girls like us.
Now, let's get to the heart of the matter on ATX, Ask the Experts.
Welcome to Heart of the Matter. This is Kim Monson. We are the Americhicks, Molly and Kim, and thank you for joining us this afternoon. We've got a great show planned for you today. Heart of the Matter, as you know, our main focus is to bring forth important issues and why they should be on your radar. We talk about issues as right versus wrong instead of right versus left. And then we tell great human interest stories about whether or not it's our World War II project, or it might be stories of how public policy is affecting people's lives. So we're going to actually cover several things on that today. Minimum wage, socialism, we're going to be talking about housing, and then we've got a great World War II story. So, we'd love to have people join us.
Yeah. Give us a call, 303-477-5600. You can email us at americhicks@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook and Twitter. And check out our website as well. We've got a lot of different stories and interviews from our World War II project that are up right now. We're about to be adding a section asking women what issues they care about most this campaign season and who they're voting for president and why. And so we'd love to hear from you, ladies. Let us know who you're voting for and why. Send those to americhicks@gmail.com.
Yeah. So, Molly, there's a lot of issues out there right now, right?
There's a lot of issues.
What's on your mind?
Well, let's start with local government, because recently I have been dragged into the Douglas County School Board meetings. By you. Yes, by Kim Monson. You know, so
we used to be friends.
I tell you, I finally know how the sausage is made, and I am not pleased. I mean, I walked out of there and
ordered the bacon.
Remember, on the airplane, they used to give you those barf bags. You need one. It's bad. It's bad. It's so crazy because it used to be college, and after I was like, okay, I'm just going to vote. Close my eyes and just vote one way the whole way down, and then these people represent me. I don't have to pay attention again until the next election. I'm sure they're doing the right thing, and you just forget about it. And that's at the national level. And now I'm realizing not only at the national level do we need to keep our eyes on the politicians, even the ones that we voted for, and give them, good compliments when they do the right thing and hold them accountable when they do the wrong thing. Even if they have the same letter behind, the R or the D or the L or the G or whatever you are, you still have to hold them accountable. So now I've been going to these local school board meetings and city council meetings.
And Dr. Cog. You can thank me later, Molly.
So I'm like, okay, I'll go. This sounds fine. And it says it's going to start at 5:30. It's going to end by 9.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were there the other night. It ended at 1:30 in the morning.
We didn't stay that long. The last time I stayed till midnight.
Yeah, we stayed till 10.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing is, especially with Douglas County, we've been hearing so much in the past few weeks that we've been there where parents and former school teachers and different people in the community are standing up and saying, listen, school board, it's about the kids. And the school board members are kind of fighting, back and forth and being petty and purposefully keeping people there as long as humanly possible. And so it was really good to hear these parents stood up. And I have a couple of letters I asked them to share with me. So I won't tell you names, but just that, some of their comments. Please consider the needs of the children. We don't have time for you not to get along. Stop talking about your personal opinions and district management with our students. Don't manipulate our kids. Don't draw them into your chaos. You're an example for the students. I mean, this is what the community is saying to the school board members. I mean, these people are supposed to be above this bantering and childlike stuff. And there's so much division taking place right now in all of America. We need to become united again.
You know, and at the meeting the other night, Molly, there is a student who is a representative of the students to the school board.
Yeah.
And there were really three particular members that you could just tell. It was like the Saul Alinsky thing. It was just like just trying to grind people down. And he finally said and what this was about was was regarding the contract for the interim superintendent. And he was wise beyond his years. He said something along the line of, you know, the way you are bringing forth these questions to these three particular school board members is you look like you're kind of setting up this interim school superintendent for failure.
Yeah.
You know, we need to be coming together.
Right.
And I thought, oh my gosh, out of the mouth of babes.
Yeah. You know? Interesting. These kids are teaching adults how to be adults.
Yeah.
And so in speaking about that with the superintendent, you know, I get it. You know, when we're trying to get our person elected, we're going to be raising up the person that we want. And we're, you know, not going to be talking maybe, you know, about the good qualities of the other person. But once the person is elected, and that's either your superintendent, that's your president, that's your governor, that's your city council member, that's whomever it is, if it's the person that's elected to do that job, and you're supposed to unite, now you work together, because it's about the kids. And those three board members, Ray, Vogel, and Lemieux, were doing everything they could to demean the new superintendent in front of everybody.
Yeah.
It was really bad.
And, you know, I think it was when I was at the meeting in June, they, as well as, you know, people in the audience, were calling for the resignation of Silverthorne and Reynolds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a bit of a complicated issue, but what had happened, they had actually had an independent investigator go out and see if, in fact, they had these two school board members had bullied this young girl that was trying to put together a protest. The independent investigator came back and said, I don't see that anything, you know, happened here, but, you know, and basically exonerated them.
Yeah.
And still these people called for their resignation. And I thought, what has happened to due process in the Constitution where, you know, people get to have a hearing, and if they have a fair hearing and nothing is found, then, you know, you need to move on. And so it's really, my heart has been very troubled, Molly, about what's happening with the school district, because I feel that these three school board members are really focused more on the vision of the teachers' union than on the children of the school that we're trying to teach.
Yeah.
And so my heart has really been restless about that. So.
Yeah. But it's a good example on the microcosm of what's happening macro, because this is happening all over the United States. And it's amazing that it's happening at this little level. So I just want to say, and then let's move on. Unite. Let's unite. Let's be, even if you don't agree with somebody, give them some respect. Look them in the eye. I mean, be kind. I mean, you can disagree without
being, but you can be respectful.
Rude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and with that brings up this initiative that you and I are starting, and that is the Plus One. We are asking everybody to do one thing each month. It might be you might choose an issue that you're going to become an expert on to talk to your colleagues, your neighbors about. But do one thing, turn the TV off, or do one less social thing, one less, you know, whatever. But we all need to do one thing to make sure that we put forth something that supports this great American idea.
Yeah. Well, I'd say make that one thing, go to one of these meetings.
Yeah.
Because you are going to be shocked.
I think you will.
Yeah.
You think
and
you
I think,
will.
I think that's the way. Keeping the eyes on the process gets adults to act like adults again. At least hopefully it does.
You know, and I had one other aha this week, Molly. And, you know, when we talked about America and that America is a nation of laws, I realized that we actually need to make sure that we are a nation of constitutional law. You know, we can have elected officials or politicians or bureaucrats pass laws that may pick winners and losers. And that is not what the vision of America is. And even we can have the citizens that may try to pass laws that could pick winners and losers. And that's not okay. Even if you have a majority, you know, like you and I've said, you know, we both have kind of red hair. If everybody in the room voted
that. Are you saying kind of?
Well, I need to see my hairdresser.
All right.
You have red hair. I'll have red hair.
That's because I just saw mine.
Yeah, in a couple of weeks. Yeah. So, but let's say we vote that everybody, you know, in the office says the girls with red hair have to do the dishes all month.
Ugh.
You know, and everybody voted, and there was a majority that voted. But yet,
I could dye my hair. I'm going blonde, baby. I always wanted to be blonde.
That would infringe on our individual rights.
Yeah.
And so the idea with America is, yes, we are a constitutional democratic republic. However, we can't let laws infringe on the rights of the individual, which I think kind of is a good segue in our next subject. And
okay,
that is, go ahead.
Oh, God.
You have a look on your face.
Well, I was just going to say, when you say the government can't pick winners and losers, I want to prove it. Everybody, go back and look at Solyndra. Go back and look at First Solar. Go back and look at SunPower. Look at some of the biggest failures that our government invested billions of dollars of our dollars into that failed because the government thought, oh, these will be successful, these will work. The government can't pick winners and losers because winners and losers are chosen by the market. If I'm willing to stand in line and wait to give you my hard-earned dollars to trade for something that you have of value, then it's going to work.
Right.
And if you create something that nobody wants, it's going to fail. And you lose your money. Nobody else loses their money. When the government picks a winner, they put our money behind it, and a lot of the times it fails, and they have to keep pumping more money into it. So it's just not a winning way to go.
But what happens is those guys at the top of each of those companies went away with a whole bunch of money in their pocket.
Oh, sure they did.
So that's not okay.
And no skin off the government's back. But we're all a little bit poor.
Yeah.
Thanks,
exactly.
Government.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. So, but, you know, it's not always politicians and bureaucrats that make these bad decisions. Sometimes the people do. Because the issues can be complicated. You know, it may kind of sound good at the beginning, but if you really look at the unintended consequences, you know, I think the people that many times they say that they're trying to help actually get hurt. And a case in point is the forced minimum wage question that's going to be on the Colorado ballot.
Right.
And, you know, I know that a lot of young people say, well, gosh, I'm in a minimum wage job. And if it goes up and it doubles, I'm going to be making double the money. But actually what happens is they may not have a job.
Right.
And so it actually hurts young people that are trying to get the skills as they move into the workforce, or maybe, you know, the poor, the vulnerable that they need to get that first job so that they can start their upward mobility. But we thought we'd bring in an expert, somebody that really understands this issue. We have Sonia Riggs with us. And Sonia is the president and CEO of the Colorado Restaurant Association. And when you talk about entrepreneurs, just think restaurant. Think about these people that have a great recipe. And they say, you know what? I'm going to see if I can make a living doing that. And then they hire people, they buy chairs, they buy ovens. You know, they are really the stimulus of the economy because they put their own hard-earned dollars and risk it. So, Sonia, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So tell us about this. I call it the forced minimum wage mandate. I don't know. Is that a good title?
It is. So this is called Amendment 70 now. It will be on the ballot in November. It has been certified. It would basically take the minimum wage, which is now $8.31 an hour, up to $12 an hour by January 1st, 2020. It'll also take the tipped wage, so there's a separate wage for tipped employees, from $5.29 an hour to $8.98 an hour by the same time frame.
Wow. So what does that mean? So the tipped employee, they receive this from the employer, and then also their tips?
Correct. And in fact, on average, tipped employees make between $18 and $22 an hour when you factor in the tips.
Okay. So they would still get that tip money, but then the employer is going, I mean, that's a big jump. How much is that?
It's a 70% increase on the tipped wage.
Wow.
Good grief. So what's going to happen? What would happen with this?
Well, can I give you a little bit of the background
first?
That'd
be great.
Just so you see kind of how we got here today. So in March of this year, before the ballot language was due, leaders from the Colorado Restaurant Association, I was one of them, and from the Colorado Association of Commerce and Industry, actually, when we had heard about this, we met with the proponents of this. They are largely basically big labor unions, that, you know, primarily from out of state, AFL-CIO and SEIU. But we met with them and asked for a compromise. We said, listen, this is going to be really a big issue to small businesses, particularly. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but we offered up a couple of options. We said, what if you looked at, you know, the tipped wage a little bit differently by increasing it as far as increasing the tipped deduction as you were increasing the minimum wage to help offset that issue that's going to be a huge problem for restaurants. What if you took it instead of in this 3-year kind of 2-month period of increasing it so quickly, such a big jump, is it'll be $1 an hour as of January 1st of 2017 and then 90 cents each January for the next 3 years. What if we took that and elongated it like we're seeing in some other states that are really taking a little bit more time to do it? What if instead of $12 an hour, it was $10.10 an hour, which you're also hearing sometimes on the federal level? And they said no. They're not willing to make any compromise. And that was really frustrating for us because, you know, one of the things that I think Colorado is really known for is one of those states where we compromise. If you can come up with a way to get small businesses together with other groups, you may be able to find something that'll be sort of a win-win for everybody. This is not that case. It's really just them bullying us into saying, this is what we're going to push, and we don't care what you think.
Are they putting a bunch of money behind this, Sonia?
They are. I think 80 to 90% of their money is from big out-of-state union groups. We've seen a lot of money from California, Washington, D.C., and New York.
Do we have any numbers, how much they're putting into it right now?
I know that I think they've brought in a little bit over $1 million, of most of which they spent getting the signatures on the ballot
okay.
so far.
Okay. So what are you doing about this? I mean, ultimately, it'll make it more expensive for people to go out to dinner, which is, you know, and that's been a really a great convenience to be able to drop by and you know, pick something up on the way home or to go out to dinner, have somebody else do the dishes and the cooking. It's going to make that more expensive.
Well, it won't only make the cost of going out to dinner more expensive. It'll also make the babysitter that you hire more expensive. But there are also a lot of other unintended consequences, such as this will actually hurt the very people that they're trying to help. We've already seen in Seattle, there was an independent study done by the University of Washington on the Seattle minimum wage. So far, they're not even finished with how far they're going to go, but that most of those people affected have seen reduced hours, so it's barely affected their compensation. In a lot of cases, actually decreased the amount of money that they're actually bringing home. We've seen job losses. We really think this is going to hurt working families, like childcare, for example. Colorado already has one of the highest childcare costs in the country. This is going to make that larger, that increase much bigger. And then elderly care is another thing that we're hearing, that there are these people on fixed incomes that are counting on care, either people coming to their home or being in an assisted living space. And those costs are going to increase, and they don't have extra income that they can count on.
Right.
So there are a lot of concerns, I think. And then just price increases for everybody.
Boy, I tell you, you know, I always think about what we're doing to our young people. And so here we are increasing their costs really across the board for many different goods and services, but yet we're also constricting their opportunity to make a living. So, you know, this kid that may have wanted to have this one job, you know, I mean, I remember my first job, if they needed somebody to work overtime, I didn't have a social life. I didn't have very many friends at that time. I just moved to Colorado. I'm like, I'll do that. But I was able to make more money. And so that's going to preclude that kind of that decision between the employer and the employee. And so if I wanted to make more money, I'd have to go get a second job, wouldn't I?
You would. And actually, I was in the same place you were. I loved that I had that opportunity when I was young. There was a recent study done specifically on this ballot initiative, and it said, I think teenage unemployment is now around 15% in Colorado, and it says that this would take it up to 25%.
Yeah, boy.
That's where we get our start.
Yeah, and you know, there's such dignity in getting that first job. So when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about that.
Your home is one of the most important investments you'll ever make. It's the place where families and friends get together to cook great meals and have robust discussions. It's the place where memories are created and dreams are built. When making big decisions about your home, you need to work with a trusted professional. And that trusted professional is Karen Levine. For nearly 25 years, Karen Levine has been helping homeowners on both the buy and sell side. So contact RE/MAX Alliance Pro, Karen Levine, at 303-877-7516 or KarenLevine@RE/MAX.net and tell her the Americhick sent you.
It's not too late to bring your family to the outdoor fun of the 88 Drive-In Theater. As long as the weather and attendance continue to hold, the 88 Drive-In will stay open into the fall. Come and see The Secret Life of Pets, starting at 8:05, followed by Suicide Squad at 10:45. Finally, once the kids fall asleep, adults can stay for War Dogs. Tickets are only $8 per person, and that does include all three features. Visit the 88 Drive-In tonight, and be sure to say hi from the Americhicks.
The Americhicks, Molly and Kim, together with the Grand Lake U.S. Constitution Week Committee,
invite you to the premier Constitution Week celebration in America. Breathtaking Grand Lake is hosting its fifth annual Constitution Week celebration, September 12th through the 17th. This year's keynote speaker is our very favorite Milwaukee County Sheriff, David A. Clark, at noon on September 17th. Joining him will be Arizona Sheriff Richard Mack and other law enforcement honorees. Don't forget Grand Lake, Colorado, home of the premier Constitution Week celebration in America, September 12th through the 17th. Speakers, activities, parade, and fireworks. You don't want to miss this special celebration. Learn more at GrandLakeChamber.com. The AmeriChicks can't wait to see you there. Remember that movie, 9 to 5?
I do. Yeah. Dolly Parton.
See, I was born by then.
Yeah.
So, before we went to break, we're talking about the Colorado minimum wage. There's a ballot initiative, and they're trying to raise the minimum wage here in Colorado, which, you know, when you put on your short-term glasses, you can go, yeah, that sounds great. Raise the minimum wage. Everybody gets more money. But the truth of the fact we know is that actually it's going to hurt the majority of the people who need these jobs the most. Because when you raise the cost of labor, you reduce the demand for labor, because an employer can't give you money that he hasn't already earned by selling a product.
Right. And, and it's not fair to ask them to take a loss.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we went to break, we were talking to Sonia Riggs. She's the president and CEO of the Colorado Restaurant Association. We were talking about the money that's pouring in from out of the state to pass this initiative, which is amazing that 90% of the money has come from out of state. I want to know, what kind of money is being raised in the state to defeat it, or in or out of the state to defeat this initiative, and who's paying that kind of money?
Well, it's really coming from a lot of small businesses. We're seeing small pottery shops in Lamar or La Junta or Aurora, or, we're seeing restaurants all over the state. There's a lot of, some people are giving $100, $25, $1,000, whatever they can give, because they know that this is really going to impact them. I just wanted to add, earlier you were saying that these small businesses really don't have this extra money, right? So it is really going to be hard on them. We actually did a survey on our restaurant members. By the way, 70% of them are independently owned single unit operators. And here's what they told us would happen with this type of an increase. 89% of them said that they would increase prices. 72% said they would reduce employee hours. 71% said that they would actually cut their staff size. And 20% of them said that they would close locations.
Oh my gosh.
To kind of put that into perspective, on a $15 meal that a restaurant owner brings in, about $5.04 is spent on employee salaries and wages. About $4.95 is spent on food and beverage costs. About $4.40 is spent on operating costs like rent and maintenance and that kind of thing. And 60 cents is left to the operator before taxes. So now take that $5 chunk of that $15 meal and increase it 40 to 70%, which you're going to see based on the regular minimum wage and the tipped wage increase. Where do they get that money? It's not that they're sitting around rolling in money. They literally have 3 to 6% profit margins on average. So they don't have any place to go. And if they already knew how to bring in that extra money, don't you think they'd already be doing it?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Small business owners, they take such a big risk. And I just admire them so much, because they put their own money, that they could be spending it, they could be investing it somewhere else, and they invest it in a company, in themselves. And they go, you know what, I'm just going to go out there and I'm going to make this work. And they have to be very tight with their budgets, and unlike the government, but they have to be very, very tight with their budgets and make sure they're very smart with their money to offer a product that people are going to be willing to pay money for and to trade money for. People aren't just going to be willing to go buy something from you because you have to sell. They have to want that product, they have to like it, and they have to be able to afford it. And I know that groups like Wendy's has already, they've already announced, they've already been raising prices to offset the minimum wage increase. They've put into place self-serving kiosks in 6,000 plus of their restaurants. McDonald's has done the same. Panera Bread has done the same. The CEO of Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, all of these guys have been coming out for the past couple of years as they've tried this in other states, California and I guess New York really to start, but saying this isn't working and we're getting hurt. So we're having to lay people off and we are increasing prices. So why in the world would Colorado think it's going to be different here?
That's one of our frustrations, and that's why we tried to meet with the proponents ahead of time to talk to them about the fact that you can't do a one-size-fits-all solution for the state of Colorado. In fact, even some of the more aggressive and progressive states like California and Washington have other other like opt-out clauses, have learning wages, have other things that are a little bit less aggressive than this particular initiative in Colorado that this one just doesn't have. They even allow for in Washington a different whether you see different wages for larger companies versus smaller, you know, small businesses, whether you see a difference in urban areas versus rural areas. This is really a one-size-fits-all, which is why we think it's really not the right solution for Colorado.
You know, I was reading something about this book to prepare for the show, and I was reading a quote from Tyler Sandberg, who's with the group Keep Colorado Working, and he said that, you know, so far a lot of this money that's coming in for this initiative to raise minimum wage in Colorado, the organizations have ties to national labor unions. Why do you think national labor unions would care about what Colorado is doing with our minimum wage?
Well, in a lot of cases, their negotiated salaries or income are based on the minimum wage.
Okay.
So that's one thing that I hear. The other thing is I think it's part of their campaign to try to unionize the industry or unionize a lot of industries that because their membership is dying around the country, you're seeing that happen. So they're trying to find creative ways to get people to join the unions.
The unions, man.
Yeah.
Remember that when they used to be out for the little guy, they actually wanted to help people?
Now it's very, very powerful. If you take a look at the amount of money that goes into political campaigns in the top 10, take a look at Open Secrets. Out of the top 10, I think six of the major donors are unions, which I just cannot understand when we talk about campaign finance and dark money. You know, we talk about businesses how they're big, bad businesses that could donate to campaigns. But then over here, somehow unions are able to just go out and influence them all across the board. It's just astounding to me.
Yeah. And then you hear from people that are like teachers' unions, people that are forced to give money and they don't have a choice. And they say, you know, these unions are giving money towards political initiatives that I don't stand for, that I don't want, that don't help me. So why is that they should be so big unions can force you to pay dues, and then they go out and do something political with it? How about the First Amendment, where we get to give our money towards political causes we care about? What about free speech? And seriously, minimum wage and waiting tables? I loved waiting tables. I love talking to people. Shocker, yeah? But you know, because what I earned was based on my service. What's right. How I did. And the same in the financial industry. You know, I mean, I love commission. I love that kind of thing. And when they try to take away that opportunity, it's just like they want to hurt people. They're not helping people. So I'm glad we're having this conversation with Sonia from the Colorado Restaurant Association, because people need to look at this thing long term.
You know, that's a great point that you bring up about kind of the little guy. And that's, I think, one of the keys to this campaign is we are really looking for and have already gathered a lot of stories from small independent businesses who think of their employees like their family, and they're really worried about having to let these people go. So we are looking for those stories. If people email us at info@keepcoloradoworking.com and give us their stories, that would really help us get the word out about just who really this is impacting.
And where can people get good information on this as well? Same place?
KeepColoradoWorking.com is the website.
Okay. Well, Sonia Riggs, CEO and president of the Colorado Restaurant Association, thank you so much for shedding light on this important issue. And we may have to talk about this again before Election Day. And when we come back, we are going to be talking with Yaron Brook.
The American idea, where we have the opportunity to pursue our hopes and dreams. And understanding our complicated tax code and reliable accounting services are critical to every successful endeavor. That's why the Americhicks, Molly and Kim, trust Predovich & Company with our accounting needs. The team at Predovich & Company takes a proactive approach to understanding your unique situation. They offer tax and accounting services across the spectrum, individual, business, and nonprofits. Contact Predovich & Company at 303-791-3000 or dpredovich.com, that's dpredovich.com, to partner with awesome professionals who can help you realize your hopes and dreams, and tell them the Americhicks sent you.
Given we live in this beautiful, capitalist, and competitive society, every business needs great branding, an effective website, professional photography, and videos to promote all of their products and services. Now, normally businesses have to go out and find numerous providers to handle all the particulars while incurring substantial cost. That's where Desi comes in. Desi offers access to a wide range of services, print design, web design, photography, and videography for one low monthly price. Desi offers packages for everyone. The Americhicks, Molly and Kim, personally work with Brandon, the founder of Desi. Desi is instrumental with our video projects, Chick Chat, Exceptional Endeavors, and These Chicks Give a Cluck. We most heartily endorse the creativity, innovation, dedication, and integrity that Brandon and his team bring to the table. Check out the Desi website at mydesi.com or call 303-359-1522 for more information. And be sure to tell them that the AmeriChicks sent you.
Often walked down this street before, but the pavement always stayed beneath my feet before.
It's just such a great song, Kim. Awesome job. Hey, welcome back to the Heart of the Matter with the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. We are talking about ballot initiatives. We're talking about the minimum wage ballot initiative here in Colorado. And, you know, while it sounds great short term, when you put on your long term glasses and start to figure out what's going to happen, it sounds like it's really going to hurt the people that it's meant to help. And that's not a good thing. So we want you to check out info@keepcoloradoworking.com. And now we've got a really special guest for you, Yaron Brook. And we're going to get into this a little further. Welcome to the Heart of the Matter, Yaron.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us today. So politicos are spreading the idea that income inequality is bad, that people who have created and attained wealth for themselves did so on the backs of people that were less fortunate. And so the government has to come in and force equality. Your book, Yaron, Equal is Unfair, challenges that theory. So we want to just ask you a little bit about that. What is the, if the real threat to the American dream isn't rising income inequality of one group over another, what is the real threat to the American dream?
Well, the real threat to the American dream is all the efforts that government engages in to try to solve the so-called problem of inequality. So the real danger to the American dream are the progressive tax system that we have, its minimum wages, its licensing laws, its government regulations and government controls. Government is the problem. It's not the solution. And what we need, you know, we've got problems of poor people not being able to rise up from poverty fast enough. We've got slow economic growth that is hurting the middle class. And we've got cronyism at the top. All of those problems are problems created by government policies. All of those problems can be fixed if government gets out of the way and stop, and people stop obsessing about inequality, which is just a gap between some people and other people. Gaps don't matter. What matters is, at the end of the day, what matters is freedom.
Yaron, talk a little bit about big government and big business. You alluded to that in cronyism. And when people rail against business or big business, I think that sometimes, you know, like our millennials, they don't understand that the biggest business out there is government.
Well, yeah, but government is a special kind of business because government has something unique that no other business has. Government has a gun. Government has the ability to force, at the point of a gun, us and business people and consumers and everybody else to behave the way they want you to behave. And this is why I believe that government should be separated from markets. Government shouldn't be involved in regulating and controlling, because what they bring to the party, in a sense, is this kind of, look, it's not just big businesses. Cronyism is all over the place. For example, you know, you need a government license to open a nail salon. Now, who lobbies for that? Nail salons that already have the license. They have an interest in keeping out competition. So cronyism affects all our businesses. And the only way to reduce cronyism, the only way to get, you know, this idea that businesses make money by using government favors is really to get rid of government controls and government regulations. So the smaller the government, the smaller control over the economy, the less favors it has to grant and the less lobbying happens. So if we want to get business out of politics, we have to get politics out of business. So I'm for getting the government out of our lives, out of our business lives, out of our bedrooms. I think as consumers, we're much smarter, much, much smarter than regulators ever are.
Mm-hmm. What about minimum wage? Because that's one of the big ones right now that people are talking about as well. And that's some things that we're looking at in Colorado possibly passing on an initiative on the ballot coming up in November. Why would you say that minimum wage is not going to help, you know, lift people up? How is that not going to end income inequality? or make things fair?
Well, I mean, so again, let me say income inequality is not a problem. I don't want to end income inequality. I want income inequality. I think income inequality is great. Income inequality is a reflection of the fact that different people produce at different levels. And I want to live in a society in which some people are so productive, so creative, that they make fortunes. Not everybody's going to be that productive, that creative, and therefore there's always going to be, in a free society, income inequality, and I think we should celebrate that because it's a reflection of freedom. It's a reflection of liberty, and not try to suppress it, not try to coerce it away. But this is the thing with minimum wage. No economist in the world, if he's really acting as an economist, not as some political hack like Paul Krugman, but as a real economist, no economist in the world would deny that raising the minimum wage increases unemployment of young people, particularly poor young people. So if you're a young person in the inner cities, you can't produce, you can't create at $15 an hour. So nobody is going to hire you and lose money on you. So you're going to lose your job. You're not going to be able to find that first job that teaches you the skills of showing up on time, of using a cash register, of treating customers and dealing with customers, kind of the skills that then build you up so that one day you can earn $50 an hour, $100 an hour, $1,000 an hour. There's no limit in a free economy. So minimum wage guarantees that the lower skilled people will not have jobs. And it does it in a number of ways. One, a lot of small businesses will have to close or move out of Colorado if Colorado has a $15 an hour minimum wage. Second, a lot of businesses, you're already seeing it, but you'll see a lot more of this, will automate. They will replace people with machines. You will walk into McDonald's and you will walk up to an iPad and you will order your entire meal off of an iPad. And even today, there are machines that will flip the burgers from beginning to end with no human touch necessary. So once you raise the minimum wage high enough, it becomes cheap enough, it becomes more cost-effective to replace human beings with machines. Now, that'll happen anyway, but why are we trying to accelerate that? Why are we trying to get the hurts? What minimum wage does is it hurts the most vulnerable people in our society. And that's tragic.
You know, Yaron, a lot of women listen to our show, and when you put that out there like that and talk about government policies and how they really hurt the poor and the vulnerable, their next question is, well, why do they do that then? What would you say to them?
I would say because the fact is that the people in power don't care about the poor. They use the poor as a political gambit. They use it in order to convince voters that they have a heart, that they are nice people, and they sell us on this idea, hey, these people used to earn $7 an hour, now they're going to earn $15 an hour. I just doubled their quality of life. And you have to think and you have to integrate the fact that that is not the case, that those people go from $7 an hour to zero because they'll actually lose their job. They can get away with it because we, the public, are not educated enough, we don't think enough, and we don't hold their feet to the fire. We don't demand the truth to them. And a lot of these concepts, economic concepts, and they fool us with them. And they do. Why do they do it? They do it because they want power. They do it because they know that if they pretend that they care about the poor, we'll vote for them. Even though I don't believe the people in power care one iota about the poor or about anybody else. What they want is the power that big government grants them. They want to be able to control us. And that's what they're doing. And you look at Congress, and you look at bill after bill after bill after bill, they all increase their power at our expense.
So, Yaron, what would you say the solution is? What should the regular person out there be doing to push back on this, you know, these programs that take away hope and dignity and all those things from people?
Well, you should never support government programs that restrict anybody's freedoms. You should always measure a congressional bill or a local bill. Does it increase liberty or does it decrease liberty? Put aside all other effects because the other effects can be complicated, can be complex. They're not obvious. They're economic. The principle on which this country was founded was the principle of freedom and liberty. We should use that principle to evaluate everything. Is what Hillary Clinton proposing going to increase liberty or decrease liberty? Is what Donald Trump proposing increase liberty or decrease liberty? Never vote for people who are going to decrease our liberties. Never advocate for a bill that's going to decrease our liberty. And demand from your representatives, have you over the last 4 years or 2 years or 6 years, whatever it is, have you increased our liberties or decreased them? And I think if you start measuring it that way, we start holding them to, you know, the core, the essence of what it means to be America, which is freedom, then I think we start getting politicians to pay attention to this. But if we think about how many jobs have you created, as if politicians create any jobs, or what have you lowered or increased, if we look at the concretes, at the little things, we lose the big picture. It should all be about freedom. And I think you can translate any government policy into this is more freedom or this is less freedom. Always go for the more.
You're on the great point. Rule, regulation, tax, penalty, whatever it is, does it increase freedom or does it reduce freedom? Great commentary. Molly, that was really a great 10 minutes. We've got another 10 minutes here with Yaron, but I think it's just important to really talk about that point when we have elected leaders or politicians or bureaucrats, whether or not it's a law or legislation, rule, regulation, we need to ask that question of you know, those people that are representing us.
Absolutely, I agree. And another thing that Yaron said is politicians don't create jobs. And as you know, government does create jobs, but they don't create jobs that create any wealth for anybody else. They're not making the pie any bigger for anybody else. And we want to make sure that the pie is unlimited, as it should be in a free country. So let's keep talking to Yaron.
Hey, welcome to Heart of the Matter with the Americhicks, Molly and Kim. We have on the line Yaron Brook, who is the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. Yaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you have a new book out that Equal is Unfair, and it looks like it's a great read. Why did you write this book?
Well, we wrote this book because over the last few years, it seems like the left has made income inequality their excuse for coming after our freedoms, for restricting freedoms in America. They have argued that income inequality is the problem behind all of the real problems that exist, problems of poverty, problems of economic growth, problems of cronyism. And they've made this the excuse, and all of their solutions for income inequality are solutions that restrict freedom and the solutions that make the real problems much, much worse. So, and the fact is that on the right, people never argue against this. So what you see is many people, like I remember Rand Paul in the debate saying something like, oh, no, we're better about income inequality because under free markets, income inequality shrinks. And it's like you can't say that because, A, you don't know that that's true. B, who cares? My whole attitude towards income inequality is who cares? I want freedom. I want everybody out there to be free. If some people excel and do phenomenally well, good for them. And the way you do well in a free market is by providing values to consumers. So I, as a consumer, are going to benefit if you become a gazillionaire. And if you're lazy and if you don't work hard, why should you make a lot of money? You shouldn't make a lot of money. And in a free market, you won't make a lot of money. So cool. Free markets allocate resources in a just way, in a fair way, based on how much value you create. And nobody on the right was making that case. So we felt it was necessary to make the case and to argue against kind of the leftist agenda.
Well, I'm glad you're making the case because a lot of people say, oh, well, look at some of these countries where big government is really, really working. Like, look at Sweden. Sweden's working great. Talk to us about why Sweden isn't the best at forcing equality for everybody else and why that's not working out the best for everybody there.
Well, first I would say if you really want to see how socialism or how inequality, the battle against inequality works, go to Venezuela, not to Sweden. Venezuela is the real model. And in Venezuela, people are starving. There's no toilet paper. There are riots in the streets.
Yeah.
People are dying. And that's what socialism leads to.
Sounds
that's
like
what
no fun at all.
Inequality leads to. Oh, no, it's a disaster. you read about Venezuela, it's a human disaster. I mean, people are really, really, really suffering. And it's really sad, all in the name of an ideology that Bernie Sanders was preaching here in America. And instead of comparing, instead of using Sweden as his example, he should have used Venezuela, because the fact is that Sweden is not that different from America. If you look at Sweden today, Sweden has less regulations than America. Sweden has school choice, which we don't have in America. Yes, Sweden has higher taxes and they redistribute more wealth. But if you regulate less and you have slightly higher taxes, that's just a slight variation on America. It's not that different, and it's certainly not socialist. It's also true that the more socialist Sweden has been in the past, the closer it's been to bankruptcy. So if we look at the history of Sweden, between 1870 and 1950, Sweden was one of the freest countries in the world. Arguably, it was more capitalist than America. They created vast amounts of wealth. They had the biggest industries in Europe. It was a thriving, successful country. And then, in 1960s, they decided they were going to become socialists, and they adopted socialism. They took all the wealth that they'd accumulated, and they started handing it out and redistributing it. Guess what happened? All the industries left. The economy was basically bankrupt. By 1994, Sweden was Greece. Greece is today, that's what Sweden was. They had to completely restructure their government, and they reduced regulations, they reduced taxes, they reduced the amount of redistribution, and they had to completely realign themselves. And today, they redistribute more wealth than America, but again, they regulate less than America. Well, all the countries in the world today, unfortunately, most of the countries in the world today, are mixed economies, mixtures of some socialist elements, some capitalist elements, and it's just a variation between the two. So Sweden's not different from America, and indeed, I always want to ask people to run this experiment. Let's have open immigration between America and Sweden. No walls, no visas, just lower the borders and let anybody come in between Sweden and the U.S. Where do you think people would go? People would go from U.S. to Sweden or Sweden to the U.S. Everybody would come over here. Yeah. And not only because of the weather, but because America is still a better place to live than Sweden is. Sweden, on a per capita basis, would be ranked 49th as a state, if we added it as a state, in terms of wealth per capita. So they're not particularly wealthy. They're not particularly anything. I don't know why anybody would want to go to Sweden.
Well, you know, that begs the question then, Yaron. What about the philosophy behind Obama's economic agenda?
Well, I mean, the philosophy behind Obama's economic agenda, and this is really true of certainly true of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and to some extent behind Hillary's philosophy, is egalitarianism. It's the notion that the moral ideal that, granted, we can't have in this world because this is an imperfect world in the way they see it. The moral ideal is equality of outcome. We're all the same. We all have the same stuff. We all live the same lives. That's what they strive towards. And in my book, I can't think of a more evil ideal than that ideal. The idea that we would force everybody to be the same. But that's what ultimately they want. Now, they all admit, Hillary, Obama, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie, they all admit you can't attain that. So we just want to make things a little bit more equal. We don't want to go all the way out.
You know, Yaron, say that, I'm thinking if everything was equal and we wanted to have equal outcomes, then Sunday afternoon in America during football season would be pretty boring because everybody get the same score, right?
It would be, and really, you couldn't play because, hey, I want to play professional football. And why am I denied my right to play professional football? And everything would be meaningless, right? Everything would be meaningless if you don't get rewarded based on merit, if you don't have a meritocracy, if we don't recognize people for their ability. That is unbelievably unjust. It's boring. It's unproductive. We would be so much poorer than we are today. Just imagine if there was no Henry Ford. Imagine if there was no, J.P. Morgan or Michael Milken, financial geniuses, or Steve Jobs or Bill Gates. Imagine if those people were denied the ability to really go full out on their genius, on their ability. And just like in sports we accept meritocracy. We all want to score in football. Why do we resent the scoring business? All money
Excellent
is,
point.
Is a way to score business. And some businesses are more productive than others. They score more touchdowns than others. They get more money than others. Cool. I love a winner. I love a winner in sport, and I love a winner in business. So it's a horrible, horrible world, the world of equality. It's an evil world. It's a world in which anybody of ability gets his legs chopped off.
Anybody
who's smart.
Well, and then what happens, Yaron, is instead of striving for excellence, it's mediocrity or just, you know, there's...
Well, it's less than mediocrity because what happens is the lowest common denominator.
Yeah.
You know, we have this story in the book. We tell the story of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. And the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia inflicted the idea of equality on their population. And so... They looked at the country and they said, wait a minute, some people live in the cities and some people live in the countryside. That's not equal. So they emptied the cities. They literally forced marched everybody out of the cities. But then they said, wait a minute, but some people are still smart, some people are dumb. So they shot everybody who was smart. They literally took them out into the killing fields and they killed them. Yeah. If you wore glasses, if you had a college education, if you were a high school graduate, you were shot dead. 2 million people they killed out of a population of 5.5. So
it's unbelievable.
Close to 40% of their own population they slaughtered. In the name of what? In the name of equality.
Wow.
Equality of outcome is an evil ideal.
So you're on.
One last point?
Last point, and then tell us how people can find you and get your book,
sure. And
we really
sure. Appreciate
it.
And the last point is this. When the Founding Fathers talk about equality, because in the Declaration it says all men are created equal, they did not mean equality of outcome. They didn't even mean equality of opportunity, which is, again, a myth. There's no such thing as equality of opportunity. What they meant, and this is crucial, what they meant was equality of rights. We're all born free. We all have a right to our life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. We all have the right to be treated by our government equally. Equality before the law. Equality of rights. That's the equality we must fight for. That's the equality they fought for. They placed their lives, their honor, this, and everything they had on the line to fight for equality of rights. Now, they were flawed because they had slaves, but it's that idea that freed the slaves in the end. So that's what I think every American today should fight for. Not equality of outcome, not equality of opportunity, but equality of rights. And
beautiful.
You know, that's freedom. That's what freedom means.
That is just beautiful. I need to get your book, so how can I do that?
Equal is Unfair. It's on Amazon. It's in every format known to man, audio, Kindle, hardback. You can get it anywhere. You can find lots of information at aynrand.org, aynrand.org.
Yaron Brook, thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, great. Yaron Brook, you're going to be here soon in Colorado. Where can people come and see you?
I am. I'm going to be in Greenwood Village in near Denver on Thursday, the 25th of August. If you want information about that, it's Hungry Minds, altogether hungryminds.us.com, hungryminds.us.com. I'll be giving a talk there about this whole issue of inequality and my new book, Equal is Unfair. Then I'm going to be at Steamboat Springs, at the Steamboat Springs Institute 8th Annual Conference. It's a freedom conference. It's going to be on the 26th and the 27th. It's a fabulous conference. I'm going to be giving two talks, one on why socialism is so popular among young people. Why did they vote for Bernie Sanders? And the second talk, again, about my book, Equal is Unfair. You can find information about that at steamboatinstitute.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time today, Yaron. Everybody, friends, you're going to want to go see him. Check out hungryminds.us.com.
Boy, Molly, have these not been two great interviews with Sonia Riggs, with CEO and president of the Colorado Restaurant Association, and Yaron Brook with the Ayn Rand Institute. And ultimately, what happens with a forced minimum wage is it hurts people and it takes away their dignity, their ability to enter the workforce and be productive.
Yeah. Well, and I'd say everybody go check out the website, keepcoloradoworking.com, because we're going to have an initiative on the ballot here in Colorado this November asking us to raise the minimum wage in Colorado. And we actually already have one of the highest minimum wages in the country here in Colorado. So it's not like it's something we need. But when you look at the amount of small business owners who have been pushing back against this and said, you know, they couldn't even afford to give a lot of money against this initiative, but they're given $50, $100 each. I mean, this will really hurt small business owners, and it's going to really, really hurt the people at the lower wage wage section and put them out of a job. And we don't want more unemployment in Colorado.
Well, and your quote from Tyler Sandberg is that it looks like $1 million has come into Colorado to promote this forced minimum wage, and it's coming in from unions.
Right.
And so people
out of state
really need to understand that this particular, I think, is it Amendment 70? Is that what it
Amendment
was?
Amendment 70.
Yeah. Be sure and vote no. Actually, I'm kind of thinking you may just want to vote no across the board on
all
everything
the
out there. Just
all
everything
the
out there. But we're going to go through that between now and Election Day, and we're going to have experts in here to talk about that. But I surely learned a lot.
Yep, I did too. I did too. And we want you to stick with us through the next hour because we are going to be talking with Karen Levine about the housing market and what we see there going forward. Because, you know, as you know, it may be time to buy another house.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time to sell.
Yeah,
I don't know. But it's good to talk to experts, and that's why we're bringing her in here.
Yeah, it will be great to have her in here. And then we also will have a great World War II story. But talking about achievement and work, I have a great Booker T. Washington quote. Says, achievement, success is to be measured not so much by the position that one has reached in life as by the obstacles which he has overcome while trying to succeed.
Yep. This is the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. Stick with us.
Hey, welcome to the second hour of Heart of the Matter with the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. Thanks for joining us. If you have any comments, we'd love to have you give us a call at 303-477-5600. Say that really fast, Molly.
You're supposed to say it twice, right, so people remember it?
Yeah.
303-477-5600.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And if you're one of those shy ones, we do pay attention to Facebook and Twitter and email as well while we're here. So follow us at AmeriChicks on Facebook, Twitter, all those. You can email us at AmeriChicks@gmail.com and check out our website.
We've been working really, really hard on that.
Yes, because as you know, we went to Normandy, we've got our new World War II project, so we're sharing as many stories as possible as we can from the greatest generation. We just think, you know what, it's one thing to read about these guys in history books, and it's another when you get to hear it right out of their mouths.
Right.
Their
right.
personal story.
So what you're working on is pulling out those interviews that we've had, and I think there's three or four of them. Of them on there right now,
yep.
If I looked at
There's
it.
There's at least four on there right now,
yeah.
And we've got a lot more to add.
Yeah.
But you know, with that, we keep adding, we keep bringing in more veterans to share their stories. We want to make sure that they're heard. It's great. I mean, these guys, they're in their 90s, and they have been keeping quiet about what happened in World War II for, gosh, like, you know, 65, 70 years.
Yeah.
And so, well, 72 years, I guess that would be
exact. You know, but it's anyway, been within the last 10 years.
But within the past 10 years, they started talking about it. And we've asked a lot of them, why were you quiet? And, you know, at first I know a lot said that they just have kind of survivor's remorse that the people beside them didn't
right.
make it. Others said, you know, nobody asked about it. Everybody, when we came back from the war, everybody already knew about it. And it wasn't until our grandkids started to ask that it started to bring it up. And I'm glad they are, because getting that information out there, I'm sure has got to help to just let it out.
Yeah. And it's important to share those stories. So we're putting together this World War II project so that we can have these memories for both ourselves and for our kids. And it's really, it's an honor to get to do this.
Yeah. So if you know anyone that has a story to share, please reach out to us. We'd love to hear it. And even if they've already passed on, but you've got pictures and stories and letters and, you know, writings, we'd love to have that.
Yeah, most definitely. So, hey, Molly, what's on your radar?
Well,
I know there's a lot of things.
There's so many things, so many things. You know, in the last hour, we talked about a couple of them. But let's get to Guantanamo Bay. So, you know, last year in November, Kim and I had heard about Guantanamo Bay. President Obama, of course, said that he wanted to close it. He wanted to let everybody go. He was trying to find homes for them all. And one of the places he was trying to send them was here to Colorado. And we said, well, we know that that freaks us out a little bit, but let's don't talk for the community. Let's go down to Fremont County and talk to the members there. And we did talk to everybody. We had like 110 people show up that first meeting with only a few days' notice, which was really amazing. And unanimously, they said, please do not bring these people here to our community. Keep them in Gitmo. And the reason was they said it's not because we're afraid that they're going to break out of jail. We're not afraid of that. We're secure in that. What we're worried about is their followers, their sympathizers, their family members, their friends that are going to come here to our community and do what they can in order to terrorize us so that we force the government to let them free. And then we're in really big trouble. And so, you know, 9 months goes by. ABC News reaches out to us again and says, hey, you know, this is going on again. President Obama is releasing more and more of these detainees, and they're looking in Colorado. They're looking in South Carolina for locations. Will you go down and talk to the people again? How do they feel? We did a second one last month. The people, 120-something, showed up, again said absolutely not. But I just noticed that a couple of days ago, President Obama released another 15 enemy combatants. And this was the single largest release under him. And it looks like there's 19 more that he is going to release next. And the what scares me about that is that they have confirmed, we have news confirmation, that over 30% of the people who have been released from Guantanamo Bay have reengaged in terrorist activities.
Right.
And their goal, unfortunately, is to
hurt Americans.
Hurt Americans,
yeah.
All Westerners, anyone who believes in freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And so, you know, the terrible thing is that we're under attack. And there should be a strategy to protect the people. That's what we hire our government for. And it seems like President Obama is repopulating the battlefield with the enemy. And as we talk to more and more World War II veterans, we talk to more and more veterans and the mothers that we had in here last week whose kids are going off now to Iraq to fight right now, I just feel so much fear for their lives and what they're going to face. And I'm worried that the commander-in-chief isn't doing what he can to protect us.
Well, there was a Washington Post article from June 8th that the headline is, at least 12 released Guantanamo detainees implicated in attacks on Americans. So when we went down to Fremont County and they said, you know, we really don't want these enemy combatants here, I don't think that they said it's okay to let them go someplace else. You know, these are our bad guys. There's a reason that they've been detained. And as you say, it just kind of defies common sense and reason that we would let these people go and actually hurt us again.
So. Yeah. You know, one of the we're waiting for the ABC News special to come out. So hopefully they said it'd be out in August. So we'll see. But one of the guys that stood up in our town hall was a school teacher. He is a school teacher right there in Canyon City.
In Canyon City.
And he said, you know, I have a concealed weapon permit. And so he's like, and I still don't feel like I would be able to protect your kids if terrorists come in here and start holding a knife to each of their necks and threatening to kill them one every 5 minutes until we release these guys out of the prison. And so to hear school teachers and parents say that and military veterans and members saying, this isn't the place to bring them. You know, they're enemy combatants for a reason. They did not commit these crimes on American soil. So they shouldn't be here in America. Let's keep them off. We've got enough bad guys trying to get into America. The last thing we want to do is purposefully bring them to America.
Right. And it's so important you mentioned it, but one of the government's responsibilities is to just make sure to protect the citizens. And why that's so important is so that citizens can safely go about their lives as they pursue their hopes and dreams. And as we talk to many, many women, the top two issues that are on their hearts right now is safety for themselves and their families.
Right.
And also the economy. And so I think that's important to really dig deep as we're looking at all of these different candidates and where their stands are. Who is going to keep us safest and who is going to actually really grow the economy? Not grow government, but grow the economy. So anyway, that's a great conversation. But I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. Molly, we are really excited to have Karen Levine in studio with us. She is a professional with RE/MAX Alliance, I believe it is. And Karen's been a great friend of mine for many years. And her picture that's on Facebook and the website, that's a great picture. So you might want to check that out. I've known her for probably 25, 26 years. And, you know, when you buy a home, Molly, it's something that is really important. I mean, it's one of the biggest investments you'll ever make in your life. And so I think it's really important to have a trusted professional, somebody that really cares about you. And she actually works on both sides of either helping people sell their homes or buy their homes. And she's got all kinds of awards. And so we wanted to have her come in because she has also been a great partner with us, as you probably hear her ads on our radio show and our archived radio spots. We are just really excited to work with such quality people as Karen Levine. So, hey, Karen, welcome. Thanks for being in here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. And you've been in the business for a while, haven't you?
A little while. I was licensed in 1986.
You were 14?
I was. Yeah. I was 14. And so I think if we do the math, that's something like 30 years in the business. And my background, which is unusual for a lot of real estate professionals, realtors in our marketplace, my background started in new home sales. And we might get to discuss that a little bit later about new construction in our marketplace. But that gave me a basis of understanding the construction of a house. And so when we're looking at resale homes or new homes, I've come with a little bit more armor, a little bit more data, a little bit more knowledge than the average realtor. I've been at RE/MAX Alliance now for 27 years, I believe. I moved out of new home construction and went into the resale market, but still represented new small builders over that period of time.
Well, and you know, your attention to detail is something that just is so impressive. You and I were talking the other day, and you said that you had gone through a walkthrough with, I think, a new buyer. And you had thought to turn the dishwasher on to make sure that it worked. I'm kind of like, I would, Molly, would you have ever thought of that? That's why you need a professional.
True, true.
Because the dishwasher didn't work.
I figured you were saying that because I need to do my dishes and you've been in my house lately. Yes, I've turned it on. I'll do that when I get home.
How about the oven? Molly, have you turned on your oven yet?
Okay, now she's just being silly. You know, the microwave works just fine. That's why we have choice.
Oh, by boom. My point is that Karen really pays attention to detail. Yeah. And as I mentioned, when somebody is looking at investing in, you know, the biggest investment of their life, it's so great to have somebody there that really thinks. I mean, there's probably something that you've forgotten over 30 years because nobody's perfect, but you're
correct.
Probably pretty close, huh?
Well, you know, we try really hard, and I think attention to detail, especially in a home purchase, is key. I also feel like I become their trusted advisor, and I'm not a salesperson. I am an advisor. I'm providing information. You're making your largest home investment, your largest investment in most cases ever, and it's where you're going to build your equity. It's where you're going to build wealth. The potential of building wealth in America is private property ownership. And so we open that door for many, many people. And in so doing that, give them that opportunity. But detail is important just because there's a lot of parts and pieces. And in a robust market that we're faced here in the state of Colorado, people think it's really easy. But there's a lot of things that day to day they aren't faced with. And so going the road on your own is generally not advisable unless you have a pretty strong background.
Yeah.
We encourage you to look for that person who can come alongside you and guide you, give you the information you need to make a good decision, not my decision.
Well, I'm glad you're here, Karen, because I've got a lot of friends that said, all right, I'm ready to buy, but, you know, we're at a high. We've been at a high. We've been growing and growing and growing for about 3 years, right? So is it going to crash soon? Is it going to keep going? What do you tell people? Where are we right now?
Well, it's an exciting market, but it is very challenging. And for the first time home buyer or the home buyer that is in that lower price range, that under 300, that under 350, it's even more challenging. But what I remind them is we have been faced with a very low inventory situation. And for those of us who remember our first economics class, which was about supply and demand. When supply is low and demand is high, prices will go up. And that's what's happened here in the Colorado and metro area is we have had low inventory consistently for 3 years. A normal market in the metro area is generally around 12 to 15,000 units. And we've been faced with 5 to 7,000 units consistently month in, month out. An exciting statistic that did come across in our latest Colorado Association of Realtors Housing Research Report, which came out on the 10th of August, said that we actually saw a decrease in prices in the median price range. And it dropped by 3% for single family and for condos. What we think we're seeing is a small adjustment, a good economic adjustment, which is we're seeing the consuming public, the buyer, giving a little bit of pushback to the seller who's maybe become a little overzealous in their pricing and has tried to continue to push those prices back. So we're seeing a little bit of an ease there that I think might be a slight correction.
So, Molly, that's happening without government. Oh, I just had to say that.
Well, maybe, maybe not, because here's my next question. Okay. So I've heard people that said, you know, they're trying to sell their house, or they're trying to buy a house, and they get really close with the negotiations, and then somebody comes in with cash and outbids them, and they're saying, you know, I don't even think that these are homeowners. I think these are investors, or this is, you know, some other group that wants to make sure that, you know, they're controlling this neighborhood. I don't know. Do you think that it's actually homeowners that are doing all the buying, or could it be investors that are buying up all these houses so fast?
I would say that there is a very healthy mix. I think the perception among the first-time home buyer or the buyer under that 350 feels like they're being beat up by the investor for certain. And cash, quote-unquote, is king.
Yeah.
But if you have a good story and you've been positioned well by your real estate professional as far as how to present yourself the best to that seller, you have a very good opportunity to beat out a cash buyer. And it's knowing kind of those innuendos of how to position yourself. And we're finding that, yes, cash is king. So it's important if you have a parent, a grandparent that can assist you with some additional funds to give you the potential difference between the appraised value of a property and if that appraised value comes in lower than your contract price. Can you make up that difference? And you present that as part of your negotiation to the seller. The seller may look at you more favorably over the cash deal.
Okay. Yeah. Now, Karen, you also will represent sellers as well, right?
Of course.
So what would your advice be to a seller in this market right now?
Well, I've had two instances recently, Kim, and I'm glad you asked the question because I'm a really honest person and I'm pretty transparent. And when I sit down with data for you, that data is going to show you where the market is and where we think the market is trending. The thing we're seeing is that overzealous seller who's overpricing their home. Ultimately, that is hurting them, and they're getting less than maybe the number I may have presented to them. So I would warn them. I would sit down with them. I would show them the upside of how we market and position them in the marketplace to maximize their equity position and to get the strongest offer. And that's not always the highest price, because what we want to see is success at the table, that they walk away with that proceeds check. And we are finding that 30 to 40% of properties that go under contract are coming back on the market. Mm-hmm. So we have to be, you know, more diligent.
Okay. And just very quickly before we go to break, I'd like you to talk a little bit about your business and how people can reach you. You do such creative marketing. I got a flyer from you in the spring that talked about spring cleaning. I put that in a pile. I should have done that. And then I got the...
your spring cleaning pile.
Yeah, yeah. And then I got the Broncos schedule. I mean, you're just so creative. And so to be connected with you is a great thing. So how can people reach out to you? And tell us a little bit about that.
Well, getting a hold of me should be easy. One, you can go to my website, which is karen-levine.com. You can email me at karenlevine@remax.net. And of course, you can always give me a call. I know that's foreign matter in today's business practice.
How refreshing.
But I know. It's really nice to hear somebody's voice on the other end of the phone. Most of my clientele is through relationships, as well as I picked up a buyer through a marketing firm I use, which is Realtor.com. And this was kind of an orphan buyer. They hadn't found a real estate agent. And they reached out to me, and I returned their inquiry. And they were very leery about engaging a realtor. And we sat down and talked about how I could best help them be successful. First-time home buyer. They were a veteran. They were doing VA financing. And we found them a home over July 4th weekend. So with that said, don't be afraid to call. I'm not going to sell you. I'm going to hopefully inform you and educate you. And then if you like me as a person and like what I can bring to the table, we can have a partnership to move forward.
Well, and we love our partnership with Karen Levine as well. And so we have Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance here in the studio with us. And when we come back, we're going to talk about what you see for the future and maybe some of the challenges that we've had in the Colorado housing market. So when we come back, Karen Levine, RE/MAX Alliance.
The American idea, where we have the opportunity to pursue our hopes and dreams. And understanding our complicated tax code and reliable accounting services are critical to every successful endeavor.
That's why the Americhicks, Molly and Kim, trust Predovich & Company with our accounting needs. The team at Predovich & Company takes a proactive approach to understanding your unique situation. They offer tax and accounting services across the spectrum, individual, business, and nonprofits. Contact Predovich & Company at 303-791-3000 or dpredovich.com. That's dpredovich.com to partner with awesome professionals who can help you realize your hopes and dreams, and tell them the Americhicks sent you.
It's not too late to bring your family to the outdoor fun of the 88 Drive-In Theater. As long as the weather and attendance continue to hold, the 88 Drive-In will stay open into the fall. Come and see The Secret Life of Pets, starting at 8:05, followed by Suicide Squad at 10:45. Finally, once the kids fall asleep, adults can stay for War Dogs. Tickets are only $8 per person, and that does include all three features. Visit the 88 Drive-In tonight, and be sure to say hi from the Americhicks.
Given we live in this beautiful, capitalist, and competitive society, every business needs great branding, an effective website, professional photography, and videos to promote all of their products and services. Now, normally businesses have to go out and find numerous providers to handle all the particulars while incurring substantial cost. That's where Desi comes in. Desi offers access to a wide range of services, print design, web design, photography, and videography for one low monthly price. Desi offers packages for everyone. The Americhicks, Molly and Kim, personally work with Brandon, the founder of Desi. Desi is instrumental with our video projects, Chick Chat, Exceptional Endeavors, and These Chicks Give a Cluck. We most heartily endorse the creativity, innovation, dedication, and integrity that Brandon and his team bring to the table. Check out the Desi website at mydesi.com or call 303-359-1522 for more information, and be sure to tell them that the Americhicks sent you.
Often walked down this street before, but the pavement
and we're walking down the street and we're looking at houses and we're trying to decide if we're gonna buy that
all at
house
once, am I
that house,
several stories
and,
high,
you know, should I buy now or should I
no
buy later? What about the interest
on
rates?
The street,
what about the supply?
Where you live.
What about the demand? Well, you know, this is the Americhicks, and we figure there's a lot of people asking questions about buying houses right now, and the biggest investment that most people make in their lives ever is going to be in their house. I mean, it's a huge purchase. So we've invited a good friend and a great partner of ours, Karen Levine, into the studio with us. She's a realtor with RE/MAX Alliance and is joining us to talk about what's going on in the market. So thanks for joining us, Karen.
You're most welcome. I'm happy to be here.
So, few questions I have for you. First of all, let's start with the fun one. So, a lot of people, I realize that these houses have just been going and going and going, and for 3 years, we've kind of been at the top, and people are like, look at Denver, the house sales are crazy. Maybe it's because of the marijuana. You've got marijuana legal, people are coming in from all over the country, moving into Denver so that they can get started on this new business. What do you say about that? Is marijuana having an effect on our home sales?
Well, personally, I have not seen it affecting home sales, but it is a question that's out in the marketplace, and it gets asked of us on a very regular basis. We would very much hope that we had data to support how we feel, but there is no valid data yet to say that the marijuana industry is affecting housing in Colorado. We do know that it is generating revenue within our economy, but there's always the question, if they can't take the money out of that industry and get it into our banking system, how can they then turn around and buy property? So the Colorado Association of Realtors is looking into doing a joint study and trying to get some good solid data so we could answer that question better, hopefully down the road here. But we know that there's a sense among the populace that there is an effect. We
yeah.
just don't know what it is.
Well, we know there's an effect on traffic. And the smell in the air. Man, there sure are a lot of skunks in Colorado these days. Woo! Yeah. Who's bringing those in? Don't bring your pets with you if you're bringing a skunk. All right. Nope. Next question. PMI. So, you know, there are a lot of people that are buying houses for the mm-hmm. first time. And if they can't come up with that full 20% up front, down or more, would you suggest that they opt for the PMI or not? Because that's going to make them pay a little bit more mm-hmm. towards their cost of their house.
So when you look at the whole cost of buying today, we are in a really unique environment, which is the most incredibly low interest rates ever seen historically. And we are looking at buyers being able to get in at under 4%, in most cases 3.5 to 3.25 for a conventional loan. So when you add private mortgage insurance, which is what PMI is, and it's insurance that gives that lender, that investor on the mortgage side, protection if you stop making your payments. That protection does cost the consumer a little bit more money, but it allows them to get into the market today at lower interest rates so that the total cost to them is really less. And it allows them to get into a house in the Denver market now as opposed to next year when we anticipate values may be 10 to 12% higher based on the trending. There's also several other programs out there. If you're a veteran, you can get into properties with zero money down. You have to be able, again, to position yourself well, offer maybe some incentive to the seller to take a little more risk on you if you're doing a VA loan. And then there's also FHA financing, which allows a home buyer to get in with as little as 3.5% down. You do pay a mortgage insurance premium up front, so that cost would never go away, but it still lets them get in with less money. The other thing with private mortgage insurance is in an appreciating market, you only have to pay that up to that 80% loan to value. So as we appreciate, once you get that equity position, you can petition your lender to release you from mortgage insurance. Yeah.
And since it sounds like you think our value is about to go up.
Okay. It's going to keep going up.
All right, good. So what about interest rates? You mentioned the value of the home going up. What about interest rates? I've heard, our government may be, the Fed may be raising interest rates, and they're going to talk about that in September. If they do, what would that do to our home loans and our home prices?
Well, I think what we would see here in the Denver market is we would see prices start to potentially level out. But when I say level out, I don't mean get stagnant. I think we still see appreciation because we still have a supply problem. And which will continue to create appreciation. But you'll see, because of the cost of the home going up, the demand may diminish a little bit, but also prices may ease a little bit. It's funny, though. The federal government has been talking about raising interest rates now for, 3, 4, 5 years, and they keep going down. So we just never know. And we, of course, don't have that crystal ball.
Right. Well, you know, and Karen, our millennials are having a hard time getting into a home. They're paying exorbitant amounts in rent. And it used to be that people were able to get into a condo, start to create some equity, but that option is pretty well unavailable here in Colorado.
Multifamily housing has been basically non-existent in our marketplace since the passing of the construction defect legislation. And what it did is it caused developers to not want to play in our marketplace because the overlay of government was so harsh. And instead of letting the consumer determine whether it was a good builder or a bad builder, buying from them because they provided a good product or not buying from them because they didn't provide a good product, the government came in and regulated that. We have been working hard. We, the Realtor Association, has been working hard to try to get some of that legislation turned around and to create a better business market for multifamily housing. But in the meantime, there's a lot of competition out there. And again, that's when I would recommend that you give myself or a professional realtor a call to help you navigate and really get you into a property. Maybe not your home for life. It's really going to be your stepping stone to create some equity and take advantage of an appreciating market today.
Well, Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance, it's really great to have you here. And you are such a great partner with the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. We just love that. And I've known you for so many years. I know that you are a true professional. I know that you are transparent. And I know that you really do care deeply about your clients, whether or not it's on the buy side or the sell side. So again, how can people reach you?
Again, you can reach me at 303-877-7516. I think Molly said you're supposed to repeat that. So that was 303-877-7516. Or email me at Karen Levine at remax.net.
Yep. And you can always check her out on our website as well at AmeriChicks.com. We've got her banner rotating. So you've got a link there. Just click on that and you can get straight to Karen as well.
Yeah, her great, beautiful, it's a beautiful picture. I just love that picture of you, Karen.
Well, thank you.
Okay. So, well, thank you so much, Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance. And when we come back, we will be talking to Dean Lang, who is a World War II Navy vet. So stay tuned.
Your home is one of the most important investments you'll ever make. It's the place where families and friends get together to cook great meals and have robust discussions. It's the place where memories are created and dreams are built. When making big decisions about your home, you need to work with a trusted professional. And that trusted professional is Karen Levine. For nearly 25 years, Karen Levine has been helping homeowners on both the buy and sell side. So contact RE/MAX Alliance Pro, Karen Levine, at 303-877-7516 or KarenLevine@RE/MAX.net and tell her the AmeriChicks sent you.
The AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim, together with the Grand Lake U.S. Constitution Week Committee, invite you to the premier Constitution Week celebration in America. Breathtaking Grand Lake is hosting its fifth annual Constitution Week celebration September 12th through the 17th. This year's keynote speaker is our very favorite Milwaukee County Sheriff David A. Clark at noon on September 17th. Joining him will be Arizona Sheriff Richard Mack and other law enforcement honorees. Don't forget Grand Lake, Colorado, home of the premier Constitution Week celebration in America, September 12th through the 17th. Speakers, activities, parade, and fireworks. You don't want to miss this special celebration. Learn more at GrandLakeChamber.com. The AmeriChicks can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to Heart of the Matter with the AmeriChicks, Molly and Kim. We have had quite the show today, Molly.
Yes, we have. Real estate, minimum wage increases hurting the people. Equality is actually unfair, and Yaron Brooks told us why. We've been getting into the Dougco School Board fights and talking about how we think adults maybe should start acting like adults and be good examples for the kids. And we've been talking about Guantanamo Bay, and President Obama just released even more enemy combatants back onto the battlefield. It's been a lot of really good, meaty conversation. But I think my favorite is I've got a lot of good information and advice in the last segment when we just talked to Karen Levine with RE/MAX Alliance. You know, she does a great job. And people are wondering, is it time to buy? Is it time to sell? We've kind of been, you know, going up, 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 up in the market over the past 3 years. And you don't want to buy high and sell low. But she says, it looks like we're going to keep going or at least stay steady. And while the rates are low and in the 3% range, this might be the time to buy. So check out Karen with RE/MAX, and her information's on our website, AmeriChicks.com.
Right. You can just click on the banner ad there, and it'll go directly to her website. So, we're going to change gears just a little bit. We have Dean Lange on the line with us. Dean, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. You're in Florida, right? Is it sunny in Florida this afternoon?
We call it paradise.
You call it paradise. Well, you know, we call Colorado paradise, too, so it's nice to know there's two paradises out there, huh?
Right.
Hey, we met you a few weeks ago at the Wings Over the Rockies when the sculpture that Frederick Arnold had done of the in tribute to the 88,000 airmen that lost their lives in World War II, when that was unveiled. And it was just really great to meet you. And, you know, we think it is so important to share these stories of our World War II vets. And so, first of all, thank you for your service.
Thank you.
And you were in the Navy, right?
Yes.
And how old were you when you enlisted in the Navy?
I was 17 and a half.
Now, how could you get in at the age of 17 and a half?
Well, they needed people, needed guys, and I wanted to serve. And after what happened at Pearl Harbor, I was very interested in flying. And I knew every plane that was ever built by any country, foreign, German, Japanese, or whatever. And so I went to the Army Air Base in Lincoln, Nebraska, where I lived, and put me through the medical. And I passed everything except the last thing. They weighed me, and they said, you're 9 pounds underweight. So
how much did you weigh? How much was 9 pounds underweight?
I think I was about 123. But the doctor says, go home and eat a lot of bananas and cream, and don't go to the bathroom and come back in a couple of weeks. He says, I think we can squeeze you through.
Oh, no pun intended. Bananas? How did banana? Do bananas help you gain weight?
It's put growth on.
Okay.
So anyway, during that several weeks, it came out in our Lincoln Journal that they had a surplus of Army Air Corps cadets, and they had transferred 12,000 into the infantry. And I said, that's the last place I want to be is in the infantry. If I'm not going to get to fly, and I just went down and joined the regular Navy.
Oh, and so tell us what happened there. You said you told me that you were a pretty good swimmer.
Yeah, my dad made sure I learned how to swim when I was 6 years old. And so the first day that you're at Great Lakes Training Center for the Navy, they had a swimming pool there. It was 150 yards. And they said you have to swim to the other end without any assistance. And there was an officer down at the other end with a clipboard. And you have to make sure that you, we don't care how you do it, just get there. So the guy in front of me, he was just shaking. He says, I can't do it, I can't do it. So they took him away and probably put him in the Army, I don't know. And so they said, Lang, you're next. And I said, okay. And I just dove in and swam the whole distance underwater. And I came up at the other end, and the officer says, leaned over, and he says, would you like to join the underwater demolition squad? And I said, and I'd already checked that out, and their fatality rate was 85%, and I said, no way.
Good for you for doing your homework on that one.
Yeah, always do your homework. Yeah. That's a good thing. So what happened then? So you're in the Navy now.
So I was assigned to the amphibs, amphibious craft, which was an LSM. But most people don't know what those are. They're a little bit smaller than an LST. They were used primarily in the South Pacific. And
and they were bigger than down. They're bigger than the Higgins boat, right? I mean, they're a landing craft, but they're
A Higgins boat is just transporting men and equipment from the troop transports to the shore. An LSM, we could carry tanks and crew and all that, and we could pull up right onto the beach and let the bow doors down, and they could walk easily without even getting wet.
So you'd gone through training, and you had gotten some orders, right?
Yeah. So when we got to the our ship was a brand new one, an LSM, and so I had volunteered to be the ship's diver, and so I went to a diving school there, and which was called a hard hat. Now, most people are not familiar with that. They're used to scuba equipment. A hard hat school, the suit weighs 300 pounds.
So is that like one of those big things that you'd see in, you know, with the, you know, the big helmet and all that? Is that what you're talking about? Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And I only weighed 130 pounds.
Because you've been eating bananas and eating cream.
Yeah, by then.
But when, once you're sitting down and you get the shoes on or the lead belt, and they put the helmet on top of you, but you have to have a guy on each side of you to help you get up and get you over to the water. But once you get in the water, you just crank your air tank on and then the weight doesn't bother. So the first guy that went into the tank, after we from the tank, we went out to the Charleston River. Now, that's a whole different ball game. We're used to a hard base on the system. The first guy went down. And we had radio communication and a lifeline and airline and all that. And pretty soon he didn't call, didn't respond to the calls. And so they said, pull him up, pull him up. Well, what had happened when he hit the bottom, he sunk into the murk and it cut off his air supply.
Oh, thank goodness you pulled him up.
It took three or four of us to to bring him up, and they took him to the hospital. They said, "Okay, Lang, you're next."
Oh my gosh!
I knew I'd read all the books on deep sea diving, so it was not a problem for me. Because as soon as I felt that murk, I just cranked that air on, and I just floated on top.
Well, it sounds like you did your homework on everything.
Well, it pays. I'm still alive.
Wow. So now you've done this training, and you. What year is this now, Dean? Tell us what year.
That'd be 1944 and 45.
Okay. So, go ahead.
We did every brand new ship has a shakedown cruise. And we stopped at Guantanamo Bay. Everybody knows what that is.
Yep.
And the skipper got on the announcement, and he says, "Don't anybody go in swimming in the water here, because they have some large barracudas and they will attack you." And so, you don't tell young men to don't do something; they're going to do it anyway.
Yeah. So probably the barracuda thing might have.
We could open the bow doors and let the ramp down, and it was only about a foot above the water, and they were grabbing guys and throwing them in. So I was trying to stay away from them, but they finally got me and threw me in, and I said, "I'll fix them." I took and swam the whole distance of the ship, 150 feet long, underwater, and they never knew it. And then I climbed up at the back end, went down, and got some dry clothes on, and came back up, and I was on the upper deck, and I said, "Hi, guys." And they wanted to kill me. They thought that they had killed me.
That's pretty funny. Okay, so you must have been a good swimmer, especially from Nebraska. I mean, there's not a lot of water to swim in, so I'm pretty impressed,
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so you think, you said that you had wanted to get into the service because of what had happened at Pearl Harbor.
That's right.
So you're in the service, you're at Guantanamo Bay. Are you anticipating that you're going to be shipped to one of the battlefields?
Well, we were headed for go through the locks and go over to Pearl and then head for the South Pacific when the Japanese surrendered. And so I was very fortunate. My battle station was the Twin 40s millimeters cannons on the upper deck. And I said, "Boy, that'll be the first place to get hit." But I'm here, and I was lucky, and we didn't get into any battles. We survived, and so it was quite an experience for a young man.
Well, and how old were you? So when the war was over, then soldiers were given the option, or Navy men were given the option to stay in the service, or they could get out. So what did you do?
Okay, I was 20 then, and I thought about staying in, but they had that fence around you all the time, and then they started clamping down, and they said, "You can't hitchhike outside the base to go into town," and I said, "You know what, I've done my duty, and I'll go out." So that was the end of my Navy career.
Now, you shared an important story with me when we were talking the other day about, you said that I think you and your wife had gone on a cruise, or that you've gone on a variety of cruises, but the first one was to Japan. And I thought that was really important, what you said. So share that with our listeners.
Yes. Our first stop was Hiroshima. We flew to Hiroshima, where we picked up the Crystal Cruise Line ship, and the first stop was Hiroshima, and I was really interested to see. We know we dropped the A-bomb there. That was the first one, and of course now at this time it's been all built back up, and you'd never know it, but they had what they called a peace park, and they had two portions of it. One before the A-bomb and one after. And of course, after it was just, there was nothing there. It was just devastated. They had one concrete building there. It was just some cables, wires, and iron rods sticking up. And The only thing I, and they had a lot of pictures on the walls of, oh, how terrible it was and all this, but I didn't see anything there that said who started it. So, but I would say about 75% of the passengers were, like myself, World War II vets. And so we went to quite a few of the islands that we fought in during World War II and the South Pacific. And but it was a fascinating trip. When we got to Guadalcanal, they were having some unrest, and the skipper said that we're not going to dock here. We're just go around it and go to the next island. So it was probably one of the best cruises we ever took. And the man who was narrating it, his dad died. And he was an officer in the Navy, and his son had taken over. And he was very, you know, when they dropped some reefs, you know, that...
But Dean, you know, I think it's important. The point that I'm hearing there is, you know, war is tragic. As Molly and I are getting to know so many of the vets, I mean, nobody likes war. But when you have tyrants and bad guys that get into leadership positions in countries and they are ruling with an iron hand and killing people, at some point in time, you have to stand up against that. So what happened at Pearl Harbor, I mean, you know, here it is, a Sunday morning, and all of a sudden, Japanese bombers arrive and just decimate, you know, the harbor. And then Molly and I had talked to a World War II vet who was, let's see, what was Van? He was on, I want to say he was a tail gunner.
Yes.
He said that if you had to parachute out in the Pacific, if you were, you know, your plane had been hit and you parachuted out, that the Japanese would come up and shoot you or chop you up in their propellers, whereas in the European theater, the Germans would kind of tip their wings to you if you had parachuted out and kind of say, you know, we'll meet again on another day. And then, I mean, my point is the Japanese were very, very cruel. And if we had not dropped those bombs, many, many more Japanese and many more Americans and many more other, you know, people in Southeast Asia would have died. So it was tragic, but I think it was important. What's your read?
Oh, it's a good thing I was not in charge, because I'd have dropped more atomic bombs after what they did to us at Pearl Harbor. There was no announcement of war. They just snuck in and just devastated. And we lost so many men there, and they were given a chance to surrender after the first one, and they didn't do it. So we dropped the second one, and then because we knew by attacking the homeland of Japan, which we were going to do, we'd lose a lot more men.
Yeah.
And because they fight to the end, they don't want to give up.
Right. So. And Dean, you said that at Peace Park, they didn't say who started the war. Did they give any, they didn't give, what kind of history did they list as their part that they played in the war?
They didn't say. They just said, oh, how terrible this is.
Huh.
And I just, you know, I just shook my head. I said, boy, you know, like I told you, if I'd had more, I'd have dropped more atomic bombs. But they never admitted to anything. They're brought up that way, that you die fighting. You don't give up.
Right. Did you meet any of any Japanese veterans from World War II while you were over there?
No, never did.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering because, and this is Molly, Kim and I, you know, we went to Normandy recently with four World War II vets. And while we were there, we were able to meet with German veterans, veterans from Great Britain. And they were all hugging each other, you know, and very friendly and able to kind of be peaceful and loving and friendly with each other right now, and saying, we're glad we all made it out of this, and it wasn't our, the Germans said, we didn't want to be in this war, we didn't want to do what we were doing, and we were forced to, and so they were really glad to see each other now, and I think that's very interesting that it's the complete opposite when you go to Japan even today.
Yeah, it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah,
and there's good people everywhere, but very, very few in the Orient. The Japanese were just—they were brought up a different way, and they're taught to die fighting and not give up.
Yeah,
right. We're talking about the Japanese in World War II. That leadership. When you have tyrannical leadership, then it causes the regular people, they're forced to do things that they might not have ever thought of. So,
yeah, and I think it's very interesting also that you're saying that they're not telling the truth historically over there, even at the memorials, because that means that the next generation may not ever know the truth of what
That's
took place.
Point,
and, here in America, I fear that we're not telling our kids 100% of the truth of what took place in World War II and what America's role was in World War II. And when we were in Normandy, we had the opportunity to meet many locals and go to many of the schools where there were elementary and junior high schools, and their kids are learning the history and they're learning the truth. And I don't know if you know this or not, Dean, but you go into a kid's school in France and they actually have the French flag, the American flag, and in one school they had a picture of Thomas Jefferson, right up on the wall. And so it's just really cool.
They love Americans
there.
They
love Americans, and they're so thankful for what we did to help free them. So,
and thank you. You truly are... Your generation, what you not only did for America, but what you have done for, really mankind. It was an amazing thing that you young kids, 17 and a half, that you went into the service to put your life on the line ultimately for other people because of liberty and freedom and this American idea. And so, we are just so honored to get to talk with you this afternoon. What would be your final thought that you would say to a young person in America today?
Just be thankful that we live in America, because we have the freedom here, and that we can go to school and learn as much as we want and be successful, that you don't always have that in other foreign countries. I'm not going to say all of them, but we're very blessed here in America, and I think it's the greatest place in the world to grow up.
Well, and it's worth protecting. That's why Molly and I do this radio show. We feel like we are now in the battlefield of ideas, and we want to bring forth this great American idea and make the case, the apologetic, the argument for the American idea. So, Dean, is it Lang or is it Lange? How do you pronounce your
name? It's Lang.
Lang.
L-A-N-G-E. It's Dean Lang.
Okay. Dean Lang, Navy World War II vet, thank you so much. We greatly appreciate your service, and people can go back and hear this interview on our website starting tomorrow at americhicks.com. So, Dean, you may want to, get your friends together and listen to this tomorrow. So thank you so much.
Well, that is very nice what you're doing.
Okay.
Well, thanks. And if you have any other friends that want to share their story that were in the war as well, let us know. We'd love to share their story, too.
Well, it was a real honor to meet Frederick Arnold. I met him when we lived in California, and knowing what he did, he flew 50 combat missions and lived. And it was just, I encourage people to buy his book because it is so fascinating. And one thing that wasn't brought out that he told me, that the movie companies want to make a movie of his life.
Oh, awesome.
Based on his book. And he says they haven't done it yet, but every January they give him a check to hold.
Nice.
And I told him, I said, if they don't hurry up, there won't be any P-38s left to film.
Door knob number five.
But he's a wonderful man, and and just blessed that he's alive today.
Well, Dean Lang, thank you so much. We greatly appreciate you sharing your story with us. And what he was referring to, Molly, was where we met Dean was at the unveiling of this beautiful sculpture. It's at Wings Over the Rockies right now. It will be there for about 6 months, that Frederick Arnold, who was a P-38 pilot in World War II, and also sculpture that he has basically sculpted. He had a young artist that helped him. He started at the age of 90 in honor of the 88,000 U.S. airmen that lost their lives in World War II. And so we met several other World War II vets that will be reaching out for their stories as well. And we would highly recommend that people get out to the Wings Over the Rockies to see this beautiful sculpture. It is amazing.
And buy his book, Doorknob Number 5. That was his handle.
Yeah, you can read it before the movie.
Yeah. So we look, you know, the book's always better than the movie.
I think
we'll see
is.
Who plays him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh, let me think about that.
Because, you know, in preparing for our trip to Normandy, of course, we went back and watched The Longest Day, and you had a lot of really great old-fashioned actors in that one.
Right. Well, and you know what, I bought the movie, so, you know, now every couple of weeks I'm watching that every night. It's just a great movie. Yeah, John Wayne and Robert Mitchum and
yeah.
Henry Fonda, and I mean, just a really long list. It's a great movie. Yeah, just a great movie. So it has been it's been a powerful show. As you all know, Molly and I work diligently to bring experts in, to bring these issues forward that we think should be on your radar, to look at these issues as right versus wrong instead of right versus left, and then human interest stories, whether or not it's how public policy affects people's lives, like forced minimum wage, what it will do to our small little pizza parlors out there, or Dean Lang's story as being a Navy vet from World War II. And it is an honor to get to bring these stories forth each week. You can get all kinds of information at our website at americhicks.com. And so it's really been, I thought, a great show, Molly.
It has. And I want to remind women, we'd love to share your thoughts on two different issues. So send us an email with a blog. We want to know who you're voting for this election season and why. And we want to know what the most important issue is to you this election season. So let us know, because we want to share that. The media tells you everybody cares about one thing. But I don't know. As I talk to people, they're saying different things. So we just want to hear the mm-hmm. truth. We just want to share what we, the people, think, because the media doesn't always tell you.
You know what? And tune in next Tuesday morning, 8 to 8:30, on Fox 31 KDVR. I'm going to be on a panel talking about this whole issues and election season. So tune in that next Tuesday morning. I think that could be kind of interesting. And our thought, Alexis de Tocqueville, I just love this. America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great.
Yes, they will. This is the AmeriChick signing off. Y'all have an awesome week.